Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, March 3rd, 2011. Quite a few topics to cover tonight. I'll be talking a little bit about electricity as it occurs in outer space. And understanding this is one of the keys to understanding a lot of issues that go on out there and things that affect Earth. The other main topic I will be talking about, there's a lot of interest in this, and I guess what I'm finding out is a lot of misunderstanding. How to prepare yourself, what things do you need to be prepared and feel comfortable with preparation? This has been brought on just by conversations with customers out there that are ordering, that with people who are listening. There's a lot of confusion, and especially a lot of people are coming online right now. So, and I'll just give this a little pre-announcement here. I'm adding some new food products to the freeze-dried food line. They're basically proportioned amounts of food in a bucket, a small, it's not as big as a 5-gallon bucket, but it's kind of a squarish, easily managed bucket with either 15 days food supply for one person or a 7-day supply for two persons. It's portioned like that in terms of meals. It's a mixture of freeze-dried and dehydrated food, but it's something that gets you going. And then the freeze-dried food I recommend for the long term. Anyway, I'll be talking about that and some of the confusion about ordering and what do you really need. Weight is a big factor. How can you manage and handle this stuff? Sometimes you have to go someplace when an emergency hits. So how do you manage all of this? You might be in another place when an emergency hits. You may have the best preparations in the world and you just happen to take a trip one day and that's when the emergency hits and you're far away from your things that you've stored up for your own well-being. So anyway, how do you manage all of this? How do you feel comfortable with the future? So at any rate, I'll be talking about that. This past Sunday, I was a guest on James Jancic's Feet to Fire show. James is in Chicago, and I'm a monthly guest on his show for 15 minutes every third Sunday of the month. And I've been doing that with James for a long time, but he asked me to be a guest for a couple hours. And so we did a show on the new book, The Diamond Principle. And each time I do a show on this book and or on any interview, of course, we talk about these topics, but we hit a lot of other main issues that are affecting the public today. So anyway, if you have a chance, go to James Jancic. It's called Feet to Fire, F2F. Listen to that archive. It would be the Sunday, the last Sunday in February, for 2 hours. I was the main guest there for, once again, talking about the new book, The Diamond Principle. Just a quick commentary on meteorites. Now, these are those stony objects that come flying into the atmosphere and light up, that give you a nice brilliant streak across the sky at night. And scientists have been studying these for a very long time. At any rate, there's a meteor called Grave Nunatax 95229, a name that probably does not mean a lot to you, and that's not really all that important, but that's the scientific name given to this particular meteorite, discovered in the mid-1990s in Antarctica. Now, understand that scientists go out in Antarctica, and annually, as the snow melts, these meteorites appear and are just laying around on the ice. So they pick these up and then take them back to their laboratories to study them, because they are remnants from outer space. They come to us basically for free, just for picking them up like you'd pick a wild plant up in the woods. So at any rate, they analyzed this one and they found nitrogen, abundance of nitrogen. They also found ammonia and hydrocarbons. But that's where the story takes the 90-degree standard science twist. And as I've said before, 95% of everything you would learn or hear in college or universities today is completely wrong. Why? Because the story about the origin of the Earth and the solar system and everything happening out there in standard science is wrong. Astronomy is leading down the path of just bad science, fairy tale science. So what happens when evolutionary biologists looking for signs of DNA in outer space and proteins and other basic building blocks of life, what happens when they come across data or information, for example, in this meteorite? That information they need, they study, they do chemical analysis on the meteorite, and as I said, found the byproducts nitrogen, ammonia, which has nitrogen included in the chemical composition, and then hydrocarbons. And as I say, that's where standard science starts going down that wrong road again. Let's see, the earth mixture compound ammonia. They are claiming that this probably could have been a source for these compounds in the early earth, which then led to life on earth. Now, one of the basic problems, and they admitted in this article, is that the early Earth, as it formed from a swirling cloud of dust and gas, according to standard science, which of course is totally wrong, it doesn't add up, it doesn't make any sense, it doesn't account for what we really see going on in the solar system. But if you take that model of standard science and how the Earth and the solar system formed, there is no nitrogen, there's no ammonia, there's no organic mixture, there's nothing there, there's no water, there's nothing that we see today. There's no atmosphere, that would have been, there would have been no source for even the atmosphere of Earth. So they have to look for other causes. This is kind of like last week I talked about the missing mass. If you look at galactic structure and the velocity curves of the stars and galaxies, etc., none of it makes any sense, so you have to invent some invisible thing like the missing mass to account for the theories, which should be simply thrown out. And as I said last week, in college we used to call that a Schwanz factor. That was the, if in this were the students that were just trying to skate by and not do a good job, they knew what the result of the experiment was supposed to be. They knew what the initial givens were in the experiment, and somewhere in the middle it all met, and there were, you know, they would include a bunch of things and write up, and in there somewhere was what we called a Schwanz factor, the number that you had to include to make the beginning part equal the end part. And that's what standard science does much of the time. So at any rate, as I said, the end product Earth is what we see today. The beginning product Earth, according to standard science, is a swirling ball of dust and gas. But there's no atmosphere, there's no water, there's nothing there, there's no organic compound, there's no hydrocarbons. None of the stuff we see today would be there. And so how did this all happen that what we see today came into existence? So they have to go out and say, well, it all came in from outer space. It all came flying in from these asteroids and comets, etc. But now let's look at what really happened to this meteorite, which contains nitrogen, ammonia compounds, hydrocarbons. Well, it was part of a comet in one time, at least a part of a comet stream, so it would have been in the tail and the atmospheric regions around the comet. And so, wouldn't it be amazing that it should contain these compounds, which are notable in the structure of comets, in the atmospheres of comets? Well, where do they come from in comets? How come comets all have these properties in their tail? When you look at the comet nuclei, which NASA has done and other science expeditions have done many times, we've now had many visits to comets, including those from Europe, Japan, Russia, and quite a few from the United States. And there's no organic compound activity. There's no hydrocarbons on the nucleus. There's no water. Nothing. But you see it in the tail of the comet. So where is this stuff coming from? If it's not coming from the nucleus, like standard science says, being bled off the nucleus. Well, it's being drawn in from outer space, and it's basically a chemical factory. As these individual atomic particles or atoms are coming in from outer space, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, carbon, all of the various basic elements, sulfur, calcium, and on. These then form the rich set of organic compounds, and they're called organic because basically they're associated with life, as opposed to inorganic compounds, which that's kind of a rough division in chemistry, but basically the organic compounds deal with things having to do with life, the basic structure of life. So ammonia was one of the primordial ingredients which we know had to exist on Earth to generate initial life, the DNA, the other compounds that eventually build up to what we see today. So at any rate, that's where this really came from. But you see that standard science, they take data, they have the funding to go out and pick these rocks up, they have the good equipment to analyze it and get the data out and tell us that it has nitrogen and ammonia and hydrocarbons, etc. But that's where it ends. That's where bad science comes in. And so most people assume that because these scientists have good equipment and they get good data, that the interpretation of that data is equally as good and sound, and that's just not true. And that's why I can comfortably say that 95% of everything you learn in college and in the university today is wrong. Simply wrong. Because they don't have the basic founding ingredients to make it correct. So at any rate, just a little note there. Earthquakes. Oh, goodness. Every place. Chile is celebrating an anniversary of their big earthquake of a year ago. Of course, they have earthquakes all the time there because they're on that rift zone that runs all the way down the Andes Mountains down to South America and all the way down to Antarctica. But as they were doing that, another major earthquake hit a very earthquake-prone area of the planet. The New Zealand is still recovering from the major quake and honoring and burying the dead there from that earthquake that happened just a short week or so ago. And then Arkansas being shaken, and I was surprised with this number. I knew there was earthquake activity going on down there. 800 earthquakes in the last, since September of 2010. And the worst earthquake in 35 years just hitting a couple days ago. So shaking people up and giving them a feeling of insecurity. They're saying that the damage to their house is cumulative. So people have cracks in their houses, in interior walls and in exterior walls. Driveways are another place where the cracks show up. One lady in one article talked about the crack in the driveway has now extended up into the garage. So the cumulative toll of these 800 earthquakes plus some pretty good sized ones in Arkansas continuing. If you live in a tent, you're probably not receiving that much damage. But that area possibly poised for big earthquakes to come. And at any rate, also Yellowstone, Wyoming, those areas remaining on the active list, as I said, Chile. So the earthquake situation around the world, and by the way, the earthquakes that we are seeing are basically the Earth relaxing from the jarring that it got a number of thousands of years ago. I want to recount that the discussion of Velikovsky. he was talking about the rumbling earth and the ancients as they, from all around the earth after the major Venus event, Venus coming by the earth twice as a large comet and then eventually settling into the orbit that we see at Venus today. But the ancients talked about the rumbling earth and boiling waters in ponds and pools and even in oceans. This was the earth just recovering from those events, the glaciation that occurred on earth. My book, The Weather Book, goes in, it goes through many pages of what would happen after a major event. And these events really shake the earth up. It's amazing that the human race survived that event. Many species went extinct. The mastodon, saber-toothed tiger. Many species went extinct during that time at the same time. So it's basically due to the ingenuity of man and survivability of man. Remember that the people who survived that event were up high in mountains, very high up in mountains, and those are the few that survived because the oceans swept over the lands, the great tidal waves that swept over the land brought the oceans far, far inland. So the very few people that survived that event were up in the elevations or very far from the ocean. Then the ocean level rose because of the tremendous influx of water. So the flooding occurred also on top of that. So we could expect, and I suspect that the U.S. Navy has discovered a lot of life, cities, whatever you might call it, remnant activity around the continental shelves. If you look on an underwater map of the world, and you can, of course, find these on the internet, look at the underwater layout outside of the continents. Just like, oh, excuse me, a sneeze snuck up on me there. Hope that was not too loud in the microphone. The continental shelves that surround the whole eastern seaboard of the United States, all around the Gulf of Mexico is a vast shelf, north of the Yucatan Peninsula, just in our own home waters. And if you go offshore, any place, any continent around the world, typically you find continental shelves. And those were above water a number of thousands of years ago. So where would people build their cities? On the edge of those continental shelves, which are now a couple hundred feet underwater. But the point is that Earth's ocean levels rose at the same time as glaciation occurred. So remember that as we went through that comet tail, the ancients tell us for 40 days and 40 nights there were torrential rains. These weren't average rains. This was like where you couldn't breathe because it was raining so hard if you were outside. So the few people that survived were up in mountains. The Greeks went back to Egypt. The Solon, the great uncle, went back to Egypt and asked the Egyptian priest cults what had happened. Where did the Greeks come from? And the Egyptian priest cults told him, this is along with their story of Atlantis going under, that the Greek was a very advanced country. It was actually involved in a major war with Atlantis, and the Greeks were winning this war when this major event occurred. And the only people that survived in Greek were the sheep herders way up in the mountains, and they came out and formed this pastoral lifestyle. And of course, that's where the gods, Zeus, and that were then passed on to the Romans, the same pantheon of gods, which represented the planets, and they were warring. Thunderbolts are running between the planets, being the electrical discharges talked of by Velikovsky in his book, as these amazing accounts were taking place in outer space. The Colbran talks about these, the original Earth before the great catastrophes, where man was just almost destroyed and then came back again. The earth was rejuvenated. So at any rate, what I'm saying is that all of the earthquake activity, the volcanic activity that we see today is a remnant. It's the earth relaxing and trying to get back to normal. And so anyway, the central U.S., of all places, happens to be in a very active earthquake region. Arkansas and the New Madrid fault line. Anyway, that activity, one would expect to continue, and I would expect that to continue possibly with some major earthquakes in that area. But for the people that live there, you have to understand that earthquakes damage structures. If you were standing out in the middle of the woods someplace, well, maybe a tree would fall over if you were very unlucky. But for the most part, earthquakes damage buildings and structures. So the most rudimentary structures, as I said, and it was not joking, if you lived in a tent, you would not have been affected. If you look at the earthquake in Haiti, the people who lived out in the countryside were fine. There was no problem out in the countryside. Maybe a few chickens died, but probably not. But the people in the countryside who were living off the land, so to speak, had no problem at all. It was the people in the cities. That's where the problem really hits home, because all of the infrastructure, the buildings are damaged, just makes an incredible mess. And from a large enough earthquake, you just can't recover. So at any rate, let me see what else. Just a quick side note on this. Everybody's heard about the issues going on in Wisconsin. It's been forefront in the news recently. The governor trying to break the unions and all of the strife going on there, back and forth. And I just wanted to throw this out, that this is the kind of thing we have been expecting to cause civil unrest. And of course, Wisconsin is like many other states. They're bankrupt. They don't have any money to pay the teachers or whatever. There's no money. So it's they're just in survival mode, and they, of course, never planned. So this governor comes in, whether you like him or not, he's got no money to pay this with. But the point is that this is all a structured economic collapse. And so it's part of the powers that be, so to speak, collapsing the economy. And one of the things that they want to do, and we knew this, I mean, me, other people, it's very predictable, they want to cause civil unrest. They want the populace up in arms, screaming, jumping up and down. And because most people don't understand what's really going on, they just think it's just this governor doing something. Well, no, he's a puppet. He's like Obama. He's like Hillary Clinton. He's like Bill Clinton. He's like the George Bush's presidents. They're puppets. They don't decide anything. Here's the rule that I always go by. If you see their name in public, they're not one of the leaders. They're not at the top. They're a puppet. And they're typically managed through their egos. These are people very much in need of being in the public limelight. And so it's very easy to control somebody like that because they're in need of being in front of the public by being elected or being in charge of something. So, you know, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, they should be off clipping coupons back down in Arkansas, living on a farm someplace. But yet they have to be there every day in the limelight. Those people have an ego problem. And so they're very easy to use. To fill that ego, they put them in positions of power so that they can stand up and speak, or Hillary calling all the ambassadors back puts her in a position of importance, and that's where she has to be psychologically to fill her needy ego. And so the basic result is those people are very usable by the powers that be. Remember that Hillary would have had to go back and be a senator from New York after running and almost winning the presidency. But why didn't she get that? Well, Hillary is for Hillary, and the big boys at the top realize that. Obama is a team player. Bill Clinton was a team player. Oh, that guy was smooth. But he was a team player. He knew how the team worked, and he knew how to be that team captain in front of everybody. But Hillary, nah, she didn't get the idea. Hillary was always for Hillary, and she never understood that when the Rockefellers were going to appoint her as being the next president, in their view, she went off and she was on her own. She thought she was more important than what she really was. So anyway, that's why she's Secretary of State now, and when Hillary says something, it's not her talking. She's just like Obama. She's reading from a prompter, and she cannot come out and say anything that Hillary wants to say, but she needs that to build her ego. She needs that position. So at any rate, the only reason I'm talking about that is this governor of Wisconsin is the same. These people are moving an agenda, if you understand that issue. They are moving an agenda. And so the agenda for the Wisconsin governor is to shake up the public. Let's get those people jumping up and down. Let's get them on the verge of screaming and yelling and jumping up and down in the street. And that's what they want. That's the next step. And then they can come in and say, well, we can't have this unrest and disorder. We need martial law here. We need the federal government to come in on this situation. And so that's the kind of thing they're going to do. We always knew it. And it just looks like this spring, everything's going to break loose, so to speak. So at any rate, that's my commentary on that. This is just part of the overall program. These people are puppets in a big, grander scheme. Let me briefly talk about electronic conditions in outer space. I'm just making a note here on my show notes. Just one second. Okay. Okay. So let's look at a particle in outer space in the solar capacitor. Okay, what's the solar capacitor? People that have read my books know. People that have listened to this show know, but there are some new people, so I'll just give the basics. The sun, by standard science, is a neutral body. It only gives off light. Well, in actuality, that's really wrong. It's very, very wrong. The sun actually produces more energy in terms of electricity than it does in terms of light. So the basic situation then is that the sun puts out excess positive charge due to fusion at its surface. Well, the end result is that outer space, all of the space surrounding the sun out beyond the planet Pluto, is an electrical capacitor, basically a battery. Understand that space, if you take a wire, let's take a wire, for example, and you run an electric current through it. Well, that wire has resistance. The electrons trying to move through that wire hit some resistance, and it causes them to slow down, in a manner of speaking. That's the simplified version. If you put a voltage across that wire, current will flow. And you also have things called resistors. The higher the resistor value, the less current will flow because the resistor resists the current from flowing. In outer space, there is no resistance. So once currents start to flow, there's nothing to stop them. So at any rate, the point is that outer space is a big battery. It's charged up due to the solar conditions. The Earth moves through this battery. The planets all move through it. And every dust particle and every intermediate-sized particle from baseball-sized up to the largest planet, Jupiter, all of these move through this electric field and discharge it to a degree. That's why when the planets align, these discharges align and hook up, and that's why we get weather situations when the planets align electrically. And it corresponds somewhat with gravitational alignments too, but it's not the gravitational alignment that's causing electrical discharge. When comets come through the solar system, we can align electrically with those. They can kick off storm activity on Earth, even though we might be millions of miles away. And of course, standard science does not recognize any of this. So the point is that I just wanted to give a simplified version to the public for why the atmosphere is of Earth, then the ionosphere is charged relative to ground. And this is part of a big solar system electrical circuit. And so what my books do is explain how this all works, how does it affect our weather. We would have very bland weather if it were not for this electric field, which is originally powered by the sun, the sun's electric field. Standard science denies all of this. They have no idea. They think that lightning comes shooting out of clouds and up and down, and it's ridiculous fairy tale science. And I just noticed at some of the international meetings, some students won awards for presenting what has to be just absolutely incorrect science, where they're talking about electricity shooting out of clouds. It's just impossible physics, yet that's what they're being taught. And obviously, just setting up the next generation of scientists with bad science. Okay, I just wanted that little side note on the electrical nature of outer space. So everything from comets to dust particles to the Earth's moon, everything in outer space then is discharging this electrical capacitor, and that leads to a whole laundry list of effects that are visible. And I just want to make mention that gravity and electricity are very separate forces. Gravity is something very individual and very unrelated to electricity. It's unfortunate that there are some quacks on the internet trying to associate these, and people with no education, no degrees, but just making statements. So you have to be aware of that. And this is one of the things, too, that as people start to come online, start to understand the issues involved with the politics of the world, how it relates to science, you listen to this show, it gives you a good background. And then also beware of the quack sites on the internet, many of them funded by the government through backdoor means. In other words, they get funding to keep them operating, or they get pictures, or they get other. This is a good key. If someone is getting, or some page is getting pictures every day from NASA, gee, how does that work? A private group that gets pictures every day from NASA. So someone is supporting through many different means some of these pages to put out basically what seems like information in your best interest, but really it's misinformation. It's meant to divert you, to misguide you. Okay, anyway, let me talk a little bit about preparedness and what it really means and how to become prepared. I talk with many people. Now, I'm selling the Mountain House freeze-dried food. We are currently getting more of a backlog. People ask, are things in stock? Yeah, there's a warehouse full of stuff, but it takes time to ship it. It takes time to process the orders and get them in line. And so, things are in stock, but the food part of it, not the water filters, those go out very quickly. The books, they're all there. The flax, that's a product that's in demand, but it goes out like pretty quickly, within a few days. We always say allow 14 days for delivery on those items. But the food, the Mountain House freeze-dried food, is getting backlogged simply because of the volume of ordering that's going on. Okay, so anyway, I'm going to introduce a new thing tonight, a new product that we have done to avert that, to get something in people's hands right now. They're called grab-and-go buckets. They're labeled with a private labeling. And so these are a combination of freeze-dried food and dehydrated foods, and they come in pre-measured packages. Now, I don't suggest buying huge quantities of prepackaged food, but for the short term, it's great, because you can order, say, a month's supply of prepackaged food, so you get three meals a day, and it's pre-measured so that, say, for a one person for 1 month, you have a set amount of food. And there it is in that bucket, and you can grab it and go. You can put it in your car. If you have a family of four people or two people or seven people, whatever, it's very easy to calculate how much of this you should buy to have it in stock just to have something to eat in case of an emergency. So right now. And then you can order the Mountain House freeze-dried food. Let's say it takes 6 weeks to get that. Okay, well now you can still get something in the meantime. Something that you can get right now. And what we've done is ordered basically the semi-loads of this grab-and-go bucket product. And it's basically a mixture of, okay, you get breakfast and then entrees, which are lunch and dinner and supper. And so it's three meals a day for a person for a month or for 3 months or for 6 months or for a year. And you can buy this like that. So you don't have to think about, well, gee, how much of this should I buy or how much of that should I buy? You can still buy the Mountain House. And for long term, I suggest the cases, the most economical way to buy storage food is the Mountain House freeze-dried in the number 10 cans, 6 cans to a case, and I only sell cases of that. And freeze-dried food will keep through cold, it'll keep through heat, through the cans are sealed with a inert gas, so they'll last, they have a shelf life of up to 30 years. So at any rate, and then talking to people, I talked with a woman this last month. She was confused. What should I get? How can I feel comfortable? You know, I've got a couple kids and I'm single parent. How much stuff should I get so we feel safe? And that's a big question. Or what kind of stuff? Should I have a generator? Should I have extra fuel? What are the real necessities? And so what I tell people is that if there's an emergency, first of all, a few basics about preparedness. Preparing for a man-made event or a natural event or a combination or terrorism or goofy governments doing goofy stuff, preparation is all the same. You have to have clean water. You have to have food. You have to have it where you are. You have to have a small group that you plan for, and that's all that you can take care of. You cannot leave where you are. People can't start running out here and there and running down to the corner store when there's an emergency, because that's where you're going to get in trouble. You have to understand that possibly all the facilities, the infrastructure will be shut down, so you won't have any heat. You won't have any water. You won't have a way to flush a toilet. You won't have a way to buy toilet paper. You won't have a way to put gas in your car. And if you have a generator, you probably won't be able to run it too long because you're going to run out of gas. And you're not going to be able to run down to the corner gas station because there isn't going to be any gas. And even if there were, there might not be electricity to pump the gas. If you have a well, unless you have a system set up for energy, electrical energy, to pump that water, unless you have a hand pump, you're not going to be able to get water out of that well, so you need an above-ground source of water. You have to understand that above-ground water might be intentionally polluted. The underground reservoir might be intentionally polluted or poisoned. So you have to be prepared for all kinds of circumstances, but no matter what those circumstances, whether they're man-made, whether they're caused by, say, flooding in your area that causes residue from a chemical factory or something to run into the water supply, whether it's by accident, a chemical spill, a truck goes over, a train derails and spills a bunch of chemicals. No matter what the source, the end result is always the same. The end result is you need clean water, you need food, you need a place to be, and you have to stay there. That's it. You probably want to have shoes. I was talking about to John Moore, with John Moore. I was on his show one time, and we were talking about the need for shoes. A lot of people don't realize that shoes are probably one of the most important things you can have. If you go camping, you always carry an extra set of shoes along in case your main shoes get wet or something happens. You have that backup pair of shoes. They can be light, just tennis shoes or something like that. But dry socks and shoes are pretty nice to have if you're in an emergency. So at any rate, a lot of people don't realize that. But, you know, these are kind of the kind of things we typically have in our house. But the basic rules, once again, you need clean water. And the freeze-dried food, the dehydrated food, or any kind of food is of little to no value if you don't have clean water. If you put mud in your dehydrated food or the freeze-dried food or whatever you have, by the way, let me go through a little dissertation here also distinguishing dehydrated food from freeze-dried. There's a lot of confusion here. Dehydrated food is done with a heat drying process, and that gets a certain amount of water. What you're getting out of the product is water. The water content in dehydrated food is too high for meat to be stored for long term. So you will not find meat typically in dehydrated food. Most dry dehydrated foods that claim to have meat really don't have meat. They have a meat substitute vegetable protein. And if you check the fine print, they'll say they have meat, but they really don't. Those are dehydrated. That's where you take the food product, you put it in an oven, basically, and you with elevated temperature, you get most of the water out of there, out of the food, and then you put it in a package that's sealed, and then you typically have to cook that item to, when you put water back with it, you have to cook it, sometimes up to a half an hour. So you have to understand the difference between dehydrated and freeze-dried food. Okay, let's look at freeze-dried food. What goes on there? Okay, first of all, you do get meat with freeze-dried. You can also get vegetables or potatoes or fruit or whatever with freeze-dried. You can freeze-dry anything. But basically, if it's a cooked item like meat or vegetables, it's already cooked. All you do is add water. So it's a much better, for that reason, it's a much better survival product, because all you do is mix water with it, let it sit there. It can be cold water, and you can eat it after the product has absorbed the water. Okay, you can also heat it up if you have a means of heating, but a lot of times you're not going to have a big energy source to be heating food and cooking food every day. Freeze-dried is much better in that respect. Plus, you can get meat, which is a major source of protein for the vast majority of us people out here today. If you're strictly vegetarian, okay, another thing with freeze-dried has about a half or less the water content than dehydrated food. Dehydrated food typically comes in packets that are so you're paying more for packaging with dehydrated foods typically than you are with freeze-dried food. That's why the 10-ounce can, the number 10 cans of freeze-dried meat are an excellent deal, because once you open them, they're dry. It's just like very, very dry. And so you can leave that open can on the shelf. You want to put the cover on it to keep dust out, of course. But you can leave that can on the shelf after you've opened it for up to a month and still just hydrate the food, the meat, or the vegetables, or whatever it is, and eat it. Just keep moisture away from it so it doesn't get moldy. It's for that reason. Okay, another reason why freeze-dried food is better is because it can go through very hot and very cold changes of temperature. Take dehydrated food, put it in a area where you got 90-100 degrees, it's going to go bad. You put it in a area where it freezes, the food is going to break down, because the water is going to break the cellular structure down in the food, just like it would in a can. So at any rate, freezing and cold temperatures or very high temperatures will destroy dehydrated food. Also not something you need when you're in a survival mode. That's why freeze-dried food is better in all those different aspects. And that's why, excuse me, I sell only the freeze-dried food in quantity for the stuff you're going to buy in the case and put on the shelf. That's what you're going to be eating for a year or two or three or 5 years or whatever you buy for. That's why it's better. You get meat. It'll withstand high-low temperatures. It can sit on the shelf open. Once you open it, it's packaged in bulk, so that open can will last up to a month. All those different reasons why freeze-dried is I consider, the only way to go for long-term food storage. Dehydrated has some problems, but dehydrated has its use. In the grab-and-go buckets, they are it's a mixture of dehydrated and freeze-dried food. And in those grab-and-go buckets, it's vegetarian. The protein is vegetarian protein. But I'll tell you, but it's a very good mixture. It's an excellent product, and it's something that's going to keep you going for the next month or 3 months or 6 months, and it's on a very measured amount, and you can grab those buckets quick, throw a couple of them in the back of your car if you have to go someplace. In fact, you could keep a couple in your car at all times. So at any rate, so let me go through preparedness once I've given the difference between freeze-dry and dehydrated food. Understand those. Okay. First of all, okay, these are the essentials that I consider essential for survival, just being prepared so you're comfortable. Have a plan. If you have numerous members of your family or immediate group, keep it limited, because your food is and your supplies are meant for that group of people. Don't go up and down the block and tell all your neighbors and relatives, yeah, we got all this stuff stored. That's not a good idea. Why? Because when emergency hits, you know, first of all, those would be the people that laugh at you. Ah, you're doing all that survival, crazy survival stuff. You know, but those are going to be the first people in line at your door if something happens. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Aunt Molly, she's got all that survival food. Let's go over there. Or, you know, whatever. That's just exactly what's going to happen. The same people that would laugh at you for having your survival food are going to be the same people that are going to be standing at your front door if there's a problem. And so, anyway, just, you got to basically take care of yourselves. And it's really an unfortunate thing. If you have larger groups, that's fine. There's another rule I've learned. It's not who you invite, but who the people that you invite. That secondhand type of situation. Just a second, I have to take a drink of water here. Okay, so I can keep talking for the next 10 minutes. And by the way, water from my Dalton water filter. Okay, so just understanding how to be prepared, how to take care of yourself. And the number one rule of survival is you stay where you are. You have to be prepared, and you have to be prepared to stay where you are. You can't have people running out willy-nilly here and there, and, oh, I'm going to run down to you know, somewhere or another. No, because that is your failure point, major failure point right there. Because when that person doesn't come back, now you got to send someone out to look for them. You see how it starts to break down. Okay, at any rate, and that's, by the way, what the government wants. They want people dependent on them, out running around, and that's where they can grab people and send them off to the government camps. And that's, by the way, why I think FEMA has been buying a lot of food, so they can set up government camps with the idea that, oh, just come here, we've got lots of food. But the thing is, they only have enough food to get you there. They don't have enough food to keep you supplied while you're there. It's just a draw to get people to go to the government camps. So at any rate, be prepared to take care of yourselves. Okay, so water. The first thing you need is water. That's why, you know, I've been selling Dalton water filters for a long time. I'm going to bring back very shortly the Preep filter product. That was so successful that it kind of went crazy there. So now we're going to open that up again, have it online. where if you're in a sludge or a muddy water situation or something, you can pre-filter for a very low cost. You can get all of that out of the water before you put water into your nice stainless steel or plastic water filter. But at any rate, the water filter is essential. Without clean water, you are going nowhere. The other thing, I was just talking with a lady today about the water filter. If I left with one thing, if there were an emergency and I had to leave my house, in fact, I carry one with me when I travel. If I had to leave my house, I would take the water, pour it out of the water filter. The water filter top collapses into the bottom. Just stick that in the car and go, because that's the one thing, no matter where you are going to need, is clean water. Okay, so that's a given. You just and then if you have, say, a cabin, the plastic water filter, Dalton water filter is great. Plus, it gives you high capacity. If you put in the five filter elements that come with it, you can run up to 50 gallons a day through that thing and filter 50 gallons of water per day. That's a lot of water when you're dealing with groups or a number of people, or you have washing, other things you have to do. So, and for the $199 price tag, that's just the filter elements themselves are worth more than that. So at any rate, that's the plastic one, the high density polyethylene plastic. Okay, but the stainless steel Dalton water filter with four filter elements, that's just the standard that you'll be giving to your children and children's children. Then also get some extra water filter elements, the four of them at one time, $140. And so anyway, the water filter is an essential first thing that you need. A lot of people don't understand the necessity of flax. I'll just briefly mention that I sell it in cases. Another thing you probably want to get is the lignin and the 40-ounce pre-ground, it's like a flour, with a little scoop. And you can put that in liquid, the pre-ground, etc. And you can use it any way that you can put it in liquids, you can eat it raw, you can put it in cooking, you can replace oils and eggs with the powder. It's cold ground, so it has a very long shelf life, so you want to get a few bags of that. And then my equation for the flax seed is one case per year per person, and that's minimum, and I would say two cases per year. And if all you have is flax, you can survive. It's the biblical survival food known in ancient times. Okay, then the other thing I'll quickly mention are my books and information, and just understanding how the world works. That's the one thing I try and give a composite picture of how the world works, not only scientifically, but also this mixed in with politics and ancient history. All of a sudden you start to understand why things are the way they are today. Okay, so I'm not going to mention too much about that, but the food. Okay, you need short-term and you need long-term food plan. And that's why I'm introducing what I call the grab-and-go buckets. And so let me go through these briefly. Now, what do you pay for a meal per day? If you went to the grocery store and you bought food and say you ate breakfast, lunch, and supper, how much do you pay per person just getting food at the grocery store? And, of course, in a survival situation, you're not going to have a grocery store. So these are set up in 15-day. This is all for one person. So if you have three people in your group or your immediate need situation, then you just multiply this by three. So, okay, let's take a month, because many of us can identify with the month, 1 month breakdown of this. So if you had 1 month breakfast and lunch and supper, that's 30 times three meals, so that's 90. Actually, you get 112 in this 1 month, buckets. And it's $230. It turns out to be $2 per meal. And so these are pre-arranged meals, and you can get it either in the regular or the hearty. And so if you're a hearty eater, then you want to get the hearty package. For the regular person, it's $230 a month for food, and that's very comparable to what you would pay if you just went to the grocery store and bought food and cooked it at home and ate breakfast, lunch, and supper. But this is prepackaged. This is something that you just mix it with water, a very minimal amount of heating, and it's ready to eat. It's a high-quality combination of freeze-dried and dehydrated food. And as I said, dehydrated is great for the short term. For long, long-term storage food, I would strictly go with the number 10 cans, 6 to a cans to a case Mountain House freeze-dried food. But since that's starting to take longer to get, we're giving you this immediate solution. So you order some of the grab-and-go buckets to get you through the first month or two. But then you get in line for the Mountain House freeze-dried food cases. Okay, so let's look at a one-month standard person, $230. That's all of three meals a day that you, one person, would need for a month. If you have two people in your family, you would order two of those, $460. For three people, you would multiply that by three. But it gives you food, and remember, you're not going to be going to the grocery store. This is an investment in your future, and you're not going to be going to the grocery store. So that month, you're not going to be paying the grocery store anything, because there isn't going to be anything in the grocery store. And people are starting to wake up to the fact that this is real, that these kind of things are going to happen. It's just my opinion. So you can also get this grab-and-go bucket, and they just send you more buckets based on the number of units that you buy. For example, you can get a 15-day supply for one person. You can get a 30-day supply for one person, or 1 month. You can get a 3-month for one person, or 6-month, or 12-month. You can get any of these in the standard or in the hearty. Now, just to give you an example, a one-month standard is $230. A one-month hearty is $340, about one and a half times the cost, but you're getting one and a half times the amount of food. So go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. That's seven letters, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, and check this out. I'm sure this is going to be a great addition to solving a lot of the people's problems out there in terms of ordering and understanding the food situation. So join me next week as I get back to some science issues. This was a very important show to introduce this and have people understand about preparedness. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.